will continue after a short break.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we're talking about parents have to allow their children to face difficulties. So, Brother Mehbat, please continue.
One crucial point regarding this, in the discussion of allowing children to face pain and explain to them in action that hopes are good, but the goal won't be achieved unless we go through difficulty.
That's right.
Is that you also teach children that there is always help on the path of difficulties.
Yeah.
This is part of giving hope to children.
Yeah.
So whilst you're giving them hope for the goal and you're teaching them that it will be very difficult to reach there, and you won't get there unless and until you go through through efforts, through struggling, right?
Yeah.
However, you should always remember that through these struggles and these efforts, you should always be helped. Someone will always be there to help you. Now, in practice, that means you as parents, right? As parents, we should always be there to help your children. Now, when I said you should allow them to face difficulties or you should allow them to face pain and you should teach them that there is struggle, however, you should always be there by their side. Right?
Like that, supporting them.
Supporting them, definitely. Yeah. Even going through the difficult yourself, when you're climbing a mountain together, you're feeling the pain as well, right? It's a difficult climb. You're together in this. And if he falls or gets injured, you're there to help him out or her out. So this is very important, that at the same time that you realize that there is difficulty, there's also a helping hand always. And as children grow up and they realize that life has difficulties, life has tests and challenges, and I need to put effort, they also realize that Allah is always with me, right? And although the tests are from Allah, the help within these tests are also from Allah. And this really is a crucial point, because you realize that in today's society, not only does the next generation think that we can become millionaire overnight without any effort, but also when they come to a point where they're challenged or they face difficulty or somebody from their life passed away or they break an arm or they have to go through a cesarean, for example, or all these difficulties of lives, that some of them are accidents, some of them are natural part of life, they go through anxiety, through depression, through all these mental issues.
Yeah.
And the reason is why is because they don't have this hope that someone is helping me.
Mm-hmm.
They don't feel that I'm being helped in this. And they don't realize that there's a goal behind the suffering.
We need to make them feel that we are supporting them always, like we are at their back, like we have got their back.
Exactly. And at the same time, realize that there is a goal behind these sufferings, right? There's a goal behind these tests and difficulties. So this leads us to this next point, that we realize that you teach children that these struggles and these pains that we go through are not just random.
Yeah.
And they're not pointless, right?
How?
I remember sometimes you go to mountains and the child asks you, like, why are we doing this, right? Why are we going through so much suffering and pain, right? Is it not possible for us to just make a lift? Isn't it easier just to make a lift or just catch a train? I remember once we were with our friends. I'll mention this and inshallah we can go to the break. But once with our friend, we were climbing the mountain. It's quite a high mountain. It took a couple of hours to get there. And when we reached at the top, we realized that from the other side of the mountain, you could take a train to the top. So at the top of the mountain, there was a train station, right? That was going, and you could take the train from the other side. And we had come from this side and we had gone through the whole pain of... And I was thinking to myself, yes, a lot of people said that. What did we just do? Could we just have gone on the other side of the mountain and just took the train all the way to the top? But no, the point is that we had to go through suffering. There's a purpose in these difficult times.
That's actually an interesting question, that was the reason behind facing struggles and difficulties. So dear audience, stay with us and we'll continue after a short break.
Wait, stop! I got Mary Jane!
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we're discussing about like the reason behind facing difficulties. Like, why do we need to face difficulties? We have Brother Magdad with us, and Brother, please continue.
So, another thing we need to explain to our children is that these difficulties have a purpose behind them.
Mm-hmm.
In brackets, I mentioned this right now,
yeah.
That slowly, slowly, as children realize, as children grow up, they realize that difficulties are not just physical difficulties.
Yeah.
Yes, when we were young, we're either hungry or cold or tired, yeah. And my legs are hurting, and my knees are paining, and these are physical difficulties and pains, which are really good. They make someone strong. But as they grow, children realize that sometimes pain becomes emotional pain as well.
Yeah.
And this should not happen at a young age. It usually comes at a much older age, when children reach age of 7, 6, 7, 8 and above. When they realize that you can feel loneliness, you can feel heartbroken, you can feel humiliated, you can feel fear and scared, you can feel an emotional pain, right? These are emotional difficulties that are also part and parcel of our journey and our life.
True.
But then slowly, slowly, as children grow up, they also realize that, and unfortunately sometimes even adults don't realize this, but there are even higher levels of pains, right? That are related to a more intellectual understanding. You know, when the Prophet says that no prophet has faced more difficulties than I have.
Allah, right?
This is what our messenger says. Now, this difficulty is not just related to a physical stress, that the Prophet was fighting the battle and he got hurt, for example. Or we have in history, for example, that he went for tabligh outside of the city of Mecca and people threw stones at him and he got hurt. This is not necessarily what the Prophet trying to say when he says that I got hurt, because other prophets were faced with much difficult physical challenges as well.
So it's interesting to note over here that, you know, even Prophet, the best of creation, even they have gone through difficulties.
Definitely. And the best of mankind, who has the highest goal, went through the highest difficulty.
Yeah.
It's all linked together, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's the best of mankind with the highest perfection and the highest goal that one can reach, has gone through the highest level of difficulty. So difficulties are of greater levels as well. So more than physical and emotional difficulties, you also have difficulties that are spiritual, difficulties that are related to the aql and our understanding. In any case, what's important for us to realize and teach our children slowly, slowly, is that these difficulties and pains and suffering that we go through in our life, they have a purpose. And that purpose is manifold. One of them is that it makes us stronger, right? It makes a person stronger.
Yeah.
Number two is that it makes a person more determined to reach the goal. You know, when you're climbing the mountain, if you don't face any difficulties, you will straight away abandon it. This is it doesn't feel like we're achieving something. Only when you feel a bit of pain, okay, when your legs start hurting when you climb the mountain, you feel like now I'm doing something important. I'm getting to somewhere. That this feels that we're reaching closer to the goal. Thirdly, through suffering, the goal becomes valuable. Right? You know, the question people ask is that if God can create us however he wanted, why didn't he create us straight away in paradise? Well, I mean, why go through the world and go through the sufferings of the world? And then why just not create us in paradise?
It's
much quicker and simple, right? The answer is that you would not have valued paradise if you hadn't strived for it, right? It's when we strive for the mountain, when we strive for the peak of the mountain, and you really, really put a lot of effort and pain and struggle through it, when you reach there, you feel amazing. And the last point why we should go through difficulties and suffering is that through that, we realize our own weaknesses and we realize our need for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The very reason why Allah gives us this imtihan and puts us through these difficulties mm-hmm. is that we turn to Allah. And so when we turn, when we face this difficulty, when you go through children and they're mm-hmm. also climbing the mountain and really struggling through it,
yeah.
remind them that Allah is helping you and you are in need of Allah. Mm-hmm. And this is the purpose of these difficulties.
Thank you so much, Brother Miglar. That was a beautiful explanation. And we're discussing about why children need to face trials and what's the purpose behind the trials. And thank you so much to your audience for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald J. Trump has abruptly parted ways with five lawyers handling his impeachment defense just over a week before the Senate trial is set to begin, people familiar with the situation said on Saturday. Those departures include his lead lawyer, Butch Bowers, whose hiring was announced last week, a person familiar with the situation said. Four other lawyers who were reported to be joining, including Deborah Barbier, a criminal defense lawyer in South Carolina, are also leaving, according to multiple people familiar with the situation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Trump Parts Ways with Five Lawyers Handling Impeachment Defense. Stay with us for more of Maggie Haberman's article. Former U.S. President Donald J. Trump has abruptly parted ways with five lawyers handling his impeachment defense just over a week before the Senate trial is set to begin, people familiar with the situation said on Saturday. Those departures include his lead lawyer, Butch Bowers, whose hiring was announced last week, a person familiar with the situation said. Four other lawyers who were reported to be joining, including Deborah Barbier, a criminal defense lawyer in South Carolina, are also leaving, according to multiple people familiar with the situation. Donald Trump had pushed for his defense team to focus on his baseless claim that the election was stolen from him, one person familiar with the situation said. A person close to Donald Trump disputed that was the case, but acknowledged that there were differences in opinion about the defense strategy. However, Donald Trump has insisted that the case is simple and has told advisors he could argue it himself and save the money on lawyers. Trump's aides contend he's not seriously contemplating doing so. The decision for Butch Bowers to leave was mutual, another person familiar with the situation said, adding that Donald Trump and Butch Bowers had no chemistry, a quality the former president generally prizes in his relationships. Mr. Trump prefers lawyers who are eager to appear on television to say that he never did anything wrong. Mr. Bowers has been noticeably absent in the news media since his hiring was announced. Jason Miller, a Trump advisor, said that the former president and his aides had not made a final decision on our legal team. Butch Bowers is the only lawyer whom Donald Trump aides had confirmed would defend the former president. Senator Lindsey Graham, a close ally of Donald Trump, who represents South Carolina, was said to have helped line up Mr. Bowers, a well-known figure in the political world there, who was working to establish a broader team. Departures of Butch Bowers and Ms. Barbier were previously reported by CNN. A third lawyer, Josh Howard of North Carolina, is also no longer part of Donald Trump's legal team. And two other lawyers from South Carolina, Johnny Gasser and Greg Harris, will also no longer be involved, one of the people familiar with the situation said. Mr. Trump is due to file a response to the House charges by Tuesday. The question of who will represent Donald Trump in his Senate trial has vexed him and his advisers since it became clear that he would become the first American president to be impeached twice. This month, Democrats in the House, joined by 10 Republicans, charged Donald Trump with incitement of insurrection for his role in instigating a violent mob that stormed the Capitol building on 6th of January, as Congress convened to affirm President Biden's victory in November's election. During various investigations, whilst he was in office, Donald Trump has struggled to find or retain lawyers to defend him, and the announcement of Mr. Bowers's hiring capped weeks of frantic searching. Donald Trump's lawyers from his impeachment trial last year are not expected to be involved this time round. They include Jay Sekulow, the former White House counsel, and Pat A. Cipollone, and his deputy Pat Philbin, and another lawyer who worked in the West Wing of the White House, Eric Hirschman. Rudolph Giuliani, who worked as Donald Trump's personal lawyer during the special counsel's investigation into whether the Trump campaign in 2016 had colluded with Russian officials, has made no secret of wanting to defend Mr. Trump in the second impeachment trial. But Mr. Giuliani is a potential witness because he spoke at a rally of Trump supporters on Wednesday, 6th of January, just hours before hundreds of people marched towards the Capitol building and rioted. Almost all of Donald Trump's advisers blamed Rudolph Giuliani, who encouraged Mr. Trump's desire to find ways to overturn the election results and to call their legitimacy into question for the latest impeachment. They also blamed Giuliani in part for Mr. Trump's first impeachment, which was driven by the former president's interest in pursuing Ukraine to investigate the Biden family. Rudolph Giuliani repeatedly encouraged Donald Trump to believe baseless allegations related to Mr. Biden's son, Hunter, and his business activities in Ukraine. The second impeachment trial is set to begin in the Senate on 9th of February. This week, 45 Republican senators voted in support of a measure brought forward by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, calling the trial unconstitutional because Mr. Trump is no longer in office. That all but five Republican senators voted to challenge the constitutionality of the trial suggested a likely acquittal for Donald Trump. Democrats have pushed back, noting that Donald Trump was impeached by the House while still in office. Still, the question of constitutionality is likely to be a key part of Donald Trump's defense. And his advisors were buoyed by the show of Republican support for the Rand Paul measure, believing it was an indication that Donald Trump would be spared a conviction. The Senate needs a two-thirds majority or 67 votes to convict Mr. Trump, meaning 17 Republicans would need to cross party lines to side with Democrats in finding him guilty. An additional vote, this one requiring a simple majority, would be needed to disqualify Donald Trump from holding office again. Still, most of his aides say they doubt that he will run for office ever again.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Djawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. Here we're talking about cutting your nails and for men shortening your moustache, and that is again one of the sunnahs of Islam. Where it is highly recommended on certain days for you to cut your nails. Tuesday has been mentioned, Wednesday and Thursday has been mentioned, Friday has been mentioned as well. Sometimes you come across some ahadith that, or some recommendations that if it's you're doing it on, for example, this particular day, then you start from your right, the far right hand, which would be your thumb on your right hand, and you finish with your thumb on your left hand. And sometimes it would be the opposite. Whatever the case may be, if you come across these kind of recommendations, and, you know, a good book to read as well, you know, besides Mafatih al-Hayat is Makarim al-Akhlaq, the famous book Makarim al-Akhlaq, that does also speak about these kind of hygienic observations that we need to go through. قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله للرجال, that the Holy Prophet, praise and peace be upon him, said to men, قصوا أظافيركم. وقال للنساء, so he said to men, cut your nails. You know, make sure your nails are always as short as possible. And by the way, it's very bad to bite your nails. So it's bad for you to cut your nails with your teeth. And we have some riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that admonish this kind of act and say it's a very bad thing. And from what I remember, it was even said that it brings about faqr and poverty. And nisyan, forgetfulness. I don't remember exactly what the context of that particular riwayah was, but you know, it is highly advisable not to cut your nails with your teeth or chew on your nails, which is unfortunately a habit that sometimes some people have. قصوا أظافركم, for men. وقال للنساء, as for women, اتركنا من أظافيركن. So then he said to women, leave some of your nails. أتركنا من أظافيركن. Doesn't mean that you prolong your nails so much that it becomes unhealthy or unhygienic, but he said that women should leave their nails to a certain length. And then he said, as to why women should leave their nails, فَإِنَّهُ أَزْيَنُ لَكُنَّ, because for women it's a part, a kind of zina, it's a kind of beautification of your hands when it comes to women. So women should leave their nails, in it being a kind of zina. Now, we're not talking about nail polish, we're not talking about putting those fake nails, we're not talking about all of those other things. We're talking about the natural nails for women. And I don't want to get into the fiqhi side of zina and things like that, that's beyond this particular discussion, but you know what the fiqhi rulings are, they're very, very clear with all of this.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Then the next hadith is from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, where he talks about akhdhu sharib, about trimming your mustache for men, you know. There are numerous ahadith that speak about leaving your beards, and that beard is a nur for a man, that it illuminates you. It's a way of keeping your face as radiant. It's a sign of maturity. It's a sign of wisdom. And the istihbab is qabdatu yad, so much so that when you do hold onto it, you are able to grab some of what your beard has. You know, you don't want it to be too long, you know, and you also don't want it to be too short. You want it to be something presentable. And I think while talking about beards, you know, nowadays we know that it's like a fashion thing, you know. So once upon a time it was extremely difficult in the 80s, in the early 90s, for anyone to do anything having any kind of facial hair. You know, and it was really, really a very, very big struggle for people to get jobs or things like that, you know. And they thought, they saw it to be being dirty, you know. If someone had facial hair, they were an unhygienic and a dirty person, you know. But now all of a sudden it's fashion and everyone wants to have a beard and things like that. But again, into the reasonable level, and the moustache should never be long. The moustache should always be short. That's the Islamic kind of attitude to facial hair. أَخْذُ الشَّارِبِ مِنَ النَّظَافَةِ, that trimming your moustache is of cleanliness. وَهُوَ مِنَ السُّنَّةِ, and it is also a part of sunnah as well, sunnah of Islam. الطِّيبُ فِي الشَّارِبِ كَرَامَةِ, and also for a person to perfume their moustache as well, which is also a part of a sunnah. Now, coming back to the issue of cutting nails, and we said that we're talking about cutting nails, and we're talking also about the practice of trimming your moustache. And here, the hadith is a hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, where he says, "Innama qussat al-adhafir." The reason why nails should be cut, لِأَنَّهَا مَقِيلُ الشَّيْطَانِ, because it is the resting place for shaytan. Maqil means resting place. It's a resting place for shaytan. وَمِنْهُ يَكُونُ النِّسْيَانِ, and a person who doesn't, you know, take care of their nails and doesn't clean their nails or cut their nails, you know, that's one means of bringing about forgetfulness. We'll continue on with these topics in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty windowpane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was a fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists, and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we see that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017 when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey. The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, you know, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied, and you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. The UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
The brawl between amateur investors and Wall Street professionals began with hedge funds and big corporations shorting the stock or betting on several small companies' fall of share prices. That captivated people's attention on social media, and in the wake of it, online campaigns led to the buying of the company's stock with aim of pushing up the price. Companies like GameStop were shorted by hedge funds and were labeled as failing by big investors. However, the online movement dramatically soared prices with its stock, trading between $112 and $480 a share. That's up from around $18 a share a few weeks ago. That's while some investors were also hoping to make a quick buck, and others seeking to squeeze the hedge funds. The movement cost hedge funds and other big investors dearly, causing investment platforms such as Robinhood to put a ban on trading stock for GameStop, AMC, BlackBerry Limited, the Nokia Corporation, and several other companies, which resulted in shares to fall by 50%. This ignited protests outside the company's California headquarters and in the Manhattan banking district yesterday. Also, groups of angry protesters gathered in front of New York's Stock Exchange and chanted, "I want my money, and I want it now." They were also holding up signs which read, "Tax Wall Street and tax the rich." The act of restricting stock trade sparked lawsuits and called for investigations from lawmakers. Consequently, the Robinhood's co-founder, Vlad Tenev, announced that the suspension of trading of the stocks will be lifted, though only a limited amount of shares could be traded under the company's supervision. He also rejected the notion that this act is in favor of the hedge funds. The war between amateur investors and Wall Street has caused mayhem in the U.S. stock market, with professional investors calling the stock movements being obviously disconnected from fundamentals. However, how powerful are the big corporations, and can they restrict investors from buying shares and stopping individuals gaining a slice of the cake?
I think what we're seeing is people are extremely frustrated because a subgroup of people on Reddit have been able to game the system of Wall Street in their favor against billion-dollar hedge fund managers, and they're finally seeing a clamoring for regulation all of a sudden on Wall Street now that it's the people at the top that are being affected. For decades, for centuries, the Wall Street fat cats have been able to profit off the misery of others. They've made billions, trillions of dollars. They've gotten bailouts. They've done speculative measures. They've profited off of the misery of others, and yet nothing has happened.
Regulators in the United States have warned that the situation is under their scrutiny following a number of share trading platform suspension of trade stocks of the GameStop company and several other firms. One of these share trading platforms is Robinhood, a company that's been accused of gamifying share trades. Robinhood is also under fire for its decision to suspend trading and has sparked outrage among investors who accuse the firm of working in favor of hedge funds and big Wall Street investors who are losing millions of dollars to an army of novice traders. The anger has now spread beyond the investment community, with U.S. politicians joining the backlash against Wall Street. Democratic Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has called the restriction unacceptable, calling for more details to be published on Robinhood's decision. She also criticized suspending retail investors from purchasing stocks, while hedge funds are free to trade as they wished.
People are upset. People are upset that they have been able to outsmart those on Wall Street and turn a bigger profit for themselves. Some people were able to turn $30,000 into $1 million, etc. They want to continue to be able to do that, and they see this as an attack on the free market. Obviously, the market has never been free, and it continues to be a game that's completely rigged. But I think the defining point is the fact that finally the free market was able somehow to be used to help those who are more at the bottom than more at the top, and obviously you have the free market intervening to prevent this from happening further.
It seems that the online mania to steal from the rich and give to the poor has been betrayed by Robin Hood, who seems to be the real sheriff of Nottingham in this case. However, the fury against control of the system of big corporations and hedge funds has left people with no choice but to unite. But could the army of novice investors win a battle against the Goliath of big corporations and hunt down the real wolves of Wall Street?
The coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan, trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
Was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible. A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually.
I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, it remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly, in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters, something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute, whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe, mostly young people, and they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and that should change.
With far-right groups such as Pediger now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders, such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte, following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows liquidated as much as $200,000 in stocks a week after the election, according to financial disclosures. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Roger Slomberger, journalist. This article is published under the heading Trump Chief of Staff liquidated as much as $200,000 in stock after election. Stay tuned for the details. Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows liquidated as much as $200,000 in stocks a week after the election, according to financial disclosures obtained recently. As a whole, the filing suggests that Meadows, who was one of the 15 wealthiest new members of Congress when he first came to Washington, continues to see his net worth dwindle as he re-enters private life for the first time in 8 years. Disclosures show that Meadows unloaded anywhere between $80,000 and $200,000 in stock on November 9th, ditching shares in two BlackRock iShares funds, Exponential Technologies and U.S. Technology, as well as the tech company Trimble Incorporation. At the time, President Trump's chief of staff was in isolation, having announced that he had contracted the coronavirus just 2 days before, likely at the White House election night. That appears to have spread infections among several of former president's top aides and friends. Politico reported recently that Meadows' job prospects upon leaving the administration were so thin that he considered taking work with the Trump organization. A day later, news broke that Meadows, who until last Wednesday was near the pinnacle of power, had accepted a position with a little-known group called the Conservative Partnership Institute, a networking hub for conservatives helmed by former South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint. Meadows, who before joining the White House was elected four times as a Republican congressman from Western North Carolina, has come under scrutiny for a number of transactions and reporting violations. For example, the one-time House Freedom Caucus leader has since at least 2018 apparently failed to disclose a loan and $18,000 in monthly income related to his sale of a deed to a fossil park in Dinosaur, Colorado, dedicated to promoting the creationist myth that humans coexisted with prehistoric lizards. Meadows also continued to pay a top staffer for months after he cut him loose for sexual harassment in 2015, a lapse for which he was cited and fined $40,000 by the White Ethics Committee in 2018. Furthermore, in 2019, Meadows failed to file a House financial disclosure altogether, and still has offered no public accounting for that year, submitting only a termination notice when he departed for the White House last March. In October, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington filed a criminal complaint with the Federal Elections Commission based on reportings that Meadows appears to have committed a number of campaign finance crimes. The alleged violations include spending thousands of dollars on personal expenses such as gourmet cupcakes, clubs, and lodging at Trump's Washington Hotel. The November stock sell-off came 10 days after Crew filed its complaint. Subsequent FEC filings from Meadows show restrained expenditures and a hike in legitimate disbursements to other political committees. According to data compiled by Open Secrets, Meadows, who worked as a real estate salesman and restaurateur before running for federal office, has seen his net worth plummet since joining Congress in 2013, from an estimated $7 million to possibly less than $1 million, according to his most recent 2020 filing. In that time, he has engaged in real estate and stock transactions and even bought a billboard in Jackson County, North Carolina, that pays him between $1,000 and $2,500 in rent per annum, according to filings. Still, it is not obvious why Meadows' net worth has declined by millions of dollars, as available data suggests. He apparently felt the need to access more financial liquidity last year, taking out a line of credit of up to $50,000. According to recent reports, some of those transactions appear to have been stewarded